Russia launches dozens of missiles at targets across Ukraine, including the capital Kiev, as Ukrainian forces intensify shelling of eastern regions. The Belgian capital witnesses a protest organized by several trade unions over pay and working conditions. And Germany's finance ministry says the country's public deficit will grow to 3.2% of its GDP next year. Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in at World News. Our top story, Ukraine says it shot down a majority of missiles fired by Russia in the latest flurry of such attacks. Chief Commander of the Ukrainian Armed Forces says 60 of 76 Russian missiles were intercepted. And in southern Ukraine, two people lost their lives after a Russian rocket hit a residential building in Kryvyi Rih city. Meanwhile, in Russian-controlled eastern Luhansk region, Ukrainian shelling of a village left 11 people dead and 20 wounded. That's according to pro-Russia forces, who called the attack barbaric. Moscow and Kiev have stepped up air attacks against each other's positions in recent weeks. Ukraine says the Russian attacks have heavily damaged its infrastructure of energy, causing widespread power and water cuts. Thousands of protesters have taken to the streets of the Belgian capital, Brussels, demanding higher wages amid rising energy prices and soaring inflation. Earlier, we discussed this issue with our guests in our news review program. Here it is. And now, welcome everyone to our news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Thousands protest on the streets of Brussels, demanding more support to deal with a growing cost of living crisis. Many of those who took part questioned how the EU can send billions of euros to Ukraine while neglecting the basic needs of its citizens across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Protest through Brussels on Friday was organized by Belgium's three largest unions. They claim the country's federal government and EU authorities are failing to adequately help citizens during the current escalating cost of living crisis. Many also question how the EU is able to set aside at least 20 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023.
We are all against this war because it's about imperialism, it's about money. There's more behind. It's not only about Ukraine and about Russia.
Ukraine is a key point, but our people here as well. And the money is there. People have to be taxed properly, especially the 1%.
It's important to help the Ukrainians, but what about the people here in Europe and in Belgium?
The EU's energy sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have backfired. Oil, gas, diesel, petrol and electricity prices are through the roof. Inflation across the eurozone is running at 10%. However, wages are not going up.
Many people can't buy the good food. Many people can't pay for our apartment.
Landlords are taking advantage from the inflation to raise the rents.
Landlords will now have another excuse. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by a half of 1% on Thursday.
And based on the substantial upward revision to the inflation outlook, we expect to raise them further.
The national strike on Friday resulted in flight cancellations, according to Brussels Airport. There were also major disruptions to tram, bus and metro services. Union members, not just here in Belgium, but across the EU, are warning of protests throughout 2023, which will impact public services, unless their cost of living concerns are addressed. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now joining us for the program is Farai Mvuti, CEO of the South African Times, joining us from London, and Marcia Baker, economic expert, joining us from Washington. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. Marcia, we're going to start with you, this crippling cost of living crisis in the European Union, and we see citizens from every single country complaining about the Ukraine war. It's putting the pinch on their energy costs, bringing energy insecurity throughout the 27 nation bloc, not to mention the inflation and cost of living crisis that a lot of it goes back to that Ukraine war. Your initial thoughts on this?
Yes. There's no question that the sanctions against Russia and other sanctions are the cost of this impossible situation in Europe and elsewhere for food and fuel. But this is like number three of a wave of three factors in recent years contributing to this that shows you how incompetent and evil the leadership in Brussels of the European Union is, and national governments like in Belgium and in Britain. A few years ago came the proposal to shut down nuclear power, saying it was unsafe, as in Germany. This is crazy. Belgium shut a nuclear plant that had no reason to be shut in September, and another one is due. Then, secondly, on top of it, came the European Union orders to go green with solar and wind, which is not reliable. It's useful in parts of the planet, but unreliable. Then the sanctions came on top of that. And so now you have absolutely impossible situation. This has to be rolled back. The fact of the central banks, the European Central Bank and the Bank of England yesterday, and the Federal Reserve in Washington, D.C., all raising interest rates on top of the fact they've already caused inflation through mega bailouts. This is like putting on the brakes and the accelerator in your car at the same time. This, all of these policies have to be changed.
Thank you, ma'am. And Mr. Mavuti, welcome to the program, sir. You're out there in London. We know the UK is no longer obviously part of the European Union, but nevertheless, it is not exempt, obviously, from this catastrophe, this cost of living crisis and inflation. We know the nursing union is about to walk out for 2 days. In their first time, their union is walking over 100,000 nurses. Over 106 years, they've never had a walkout. They're doing it now. We know rail workers have done it, crippling transportation. We know paramedics are doing it, along with other sectors. Tell us your initial thoughts on how things are unfolding out in the UK.
Well, thank you again for having me. In terms of the walkouts from the nurses, that actually began today. So we're going to see that, and it's not just the nurses. We've had rail strikes, we'll have rail worker strikes, that is, and ambulances. It spreads across to fire stations and so forth when it comes to the staffing levels. So that's going to, of course, impact not only just the aspect of staffing levels, which is already a crisis as we speak. Europe has faced an inflation in as far as its ability to recruit staff. So that's going to further increase. And part of the reasons why there are these strikes, a majority of the unions are asking for greater pay, but equally they're asking for better equipment to be able to deliver quality services. But this all stems from, as my colleague had said earlier, the policy approach when it comes to the issue in Russia and Ukraine. The mere policy that stampedes the ability of the UK and Europe to have access to cheaper oil and gas has an impact, a direct impact on wages, because it raises inflation. And as a consequence, now we're seeing quite a high number of people looking at this quite closely and thinking, because of the dire situation they're currently going, how much of an impact it will have going further. And I don't see that there will be any policy shift, especially because of the political spin that has gone into the campaign against Russia. Or this is not to suggest that Russia is right or wrong. It's purely to analyze it as it exists. Currently, the UK continues to have a high level of unemployment. Unemployment figures continue to increase. The government has completely lost goodwill. So this is possibly a government whose polling has gone lower than within a space of the last 20 years. We've never seen such low numbers in as far as the way the government is polling, which speaks directly to its economic policies. And as you know, earlier this year, we've had Boris Johnson to Liz Truss, and now we have Rishi Sunak. And that is directly the causation, of course, being the instability, not only from an ideological perspective within the political landscape, but more so with the unsettled realities that the population has to face.
All right, thank you both for joining us on the program. Time has gotten the better of us. Barcia Baker, economic expert, joining us out of Washington, D.C., and Farai Ian Mvuti, CEO from the Southern African Times. They're joining us out of London. Germany says its public deficit will grow to 3.25% next year as the energy crunch pushes the government to dip further down into its pockets. The finance minister, Christian Lindner, warned that if government spending goes up, that figure could even reach 4.5%. The government has unveiled a 200 billion euro plan to dampen the effects of soaring energy prices for the public. Part of that plan is to put a cap on gas prices for households and businesses. However, the German economy is still expected to contract by 0.4% in 2023. The country expects its net borrowing to climb above 45 billion euros, nearly triple the initial estimates. Twitter owner Elon Musk is under fire after the social media platform suspended the accounts of several journalists. The European Union has decried the move as arbitrary. EU Commissioner Vera Jourova expressed concern about the suspensions, warning Musk of sanctions against Twitter. UN spokesman Stéphane Dujarric also stressed the media voices should not be silenced on a platform that professes to give space to the freedom of speech. Meanwhile, Reporters Without Borders says the way Musk is running Twitter poses, quote, a major threat to democracy. The France-based NGO described Musk's leadership of Twitter as a disaster for the right to information. Journalists from CNN, The New York Times, and The Washington Post were among those cut off from the platform as Musk accused them of helping people track and endanger his family. And now Jordan says it will take tough measures and deploy more anti-riot police against demonstrators after overnight protests over fuel price hikes turned deadly.
After what happened yesterday, there will be tough security measures and security forces will be fortified in the areas that are witnessing these actions.
Fareya said the government will allow peaceful protests, but it will not tolerate any rioting that destroys public or private property. He was referring to riots in a southern city that left a police officer dead. On Friday, people staged sit-ins with activists calling for more protests against fuel price rises that have added to cost of living squeeze. Tensions have mounted in several cities in southern Jordan, in particular, after sporadic strikes by truck drivers. The government has promised to examine the truckers' demands. However, the government says it cannot do much more to cap fuel prices, as this will breach Jordan's deal with the International Monetary Fund. Israeli forces have attacked at least three villages near Nablus, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured following anti-settlement protests. We were joined earlier by our correspondent out of Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for the latest.
Well, a number of anti-settlement protests had taken place in some Palestinian towns in Nablus area. We are speaking about a protest in the village of Beit Dajan, East Nablus, as well as another protest had taken place in the village of Osarin, South Nablus. In both the protests, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinians. They throw heavy tear gas and stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets in order to disperse the protesters. According to Palestinian paramedics, a number of Palestinians had been wounded, mainly had suffocated due to inhaling tear gas in the village of Osarin. 15 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces in the village of Beit Dajan, East Nablus. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank and also in one of the villages near Nablus, this time the Israeli settlers have attacked the Palestinians in the village, in two villages, in the village of Madama and Bunin, South Nablus. Under the protection of Israeli forces, when Palestinians had been taking place in a protest in order to express their anger and rejection of the settlement and the confiscation of their land. This time, the settlers, under the protection of Israeli forces, have attacked the Palestinians, and a number of Palestinians had been wounded.
Saudi-led coalition has once again blocked two Yemeni-bound fuel ships from unloading in the port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni government has condemned the blockade as a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, as Yusuf Mowry reports.
The Saudi-led coalition has once again detained two fuel ships, preventing them from reaching the crucial western port of Hodeidah. The Yemeni Petroleum Company says the two fuel vessels were detained despite obtaining the necessary permits and being cleared from inspection in the port of Djibouti.
Preventing fuel ships from entering Yemen continues to take its toll on the country's battered economy. It has led to an increase in food prices and basic supplies and has made life harder for the Yemeni people as Saudi Arabia continues its blockade.
Rashid Al-Haddad, an economic expert, says the seizure of the fuel ships is just one of many war tactics employed by the Saudi-led coalition to put pressure on the Yemeni people.
The Saudi aggression is always exerting effort to make life difficult for all Yemenis by depriving them of fuel resources. 70% of fuel enters the country through the port of Hodeidah, which affects 22 million people. The Saudi-led coalition is using this as a war tactic, not against Ansarullah, but against the Yemeni people as a collective punishment.
Considering the expected rise in shipping prices, Dalal, a local fruit merchant, says he will be forced to raise his prices if no fuel enters the country.
This watermelon is normally sold for 1,500 Yemeni riyals when fuel is available. However, whenever they prevent fuel from entering Yemen, the price of this watermelon increases from 1,500 to 3,000 Yemeni riyals.
This blockade has caused an economic crisis. The price of wheat and fuel have increased. We don't have anything and we're not even being paid salaries. We're besieged from all aspects of life.
The Yemeni government says the illegal seizure of Yemeni oil is an act of war and a violation of Yemen's sovereignty, which will be met with force if continued. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Economists are saying recession in the Eurozone is almost inevitable. According to surveys, the countries of the Eurozone will face an economic recession in the next year with a probability of about 80% due to a sharp increase in energy prices and a sharp decrease in the supply of electricity and gas. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story. According to the European Commission's autumn economic forecast, the Eurozone and most European Union countries will head to an economic recession in the last quarter of 2022. The European Union Economy Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, at a press conference said, "The economic situation has deteriorated markedly and we're heading into two quarters of contraction." The EU's executive revised up its inflation forecast from July, predicting that prices would peak at year-end and remain high in 2023. Brussels said inflation will average 9.3% in the European Union and 8.5% in the Eurozone for 2022. The European Commission said in a statement, "The European Union is among the most exposed advanced economies to high prices due to its geographical proximity to the war and heavy reliance on gas imports from Russia." The statement added, "The energy crisis is eroding households' purchasing power and weighing on production." While prices are expected to come down in 2023, inflation is still predicted to be at 7% in the European Union and 6.1% in the Eurozone, before decreasing to 3% in the European Union and 2.6% in the Eurozone in 2024. The EU forecast was based on the assumption that geopolitical tensions such as the war in Ukraine would neither normalize nor escalate, and that sanctions against Russia would remain in place. But the EU Economy Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, said, "The impact of adopted or planned fiscal energy measures adds uncertainty to the forecast for energy inflation. Average inflation for 2022 was highest in the Baltic countries, where it was forecast to be 19.3% in Estonia, 18.9% in Lithuania, and 16.9% in Latvia this year. EU labour markets are expected to react to the slowing economy, but remain resilient, with unemployment growth expected to be at 1.8% before coming to a standstill in 2023. Unemployment rates in the European Union were projected to be at 6.2% in 2022, 6.5% in 2023, and 6.4% in 2024. The European Central Bank, the ECB, has meanwhile raised interest rates three times this year to tackle the rising prices. The ECB could continue to raise interest rates, which impacts commercial banks, meaning that mortgages and credit cards would become more expensive. The Central Bank's Governing Council said at the end of last month that inflation remained far too high and will stay above the target for an extended period of time. According to Eurostat's flash estimate, at the end of the month, inflation in the Eurozone reached a record high of 10.7% in October. The increase was fueled by energy prices, which Eurostat estimated were 41.9% higher than in the same month last year. Prices for food and tobacco were up by 13.1% compared to the same time last year. There have been multiple strike movements in European Union countries demanding higher wages because of record inflation. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story. The European economy is slowing down and a contraction is predicted at least for the winter months due to the energy crisis and high inflation. Pascal Donohue, president of the Eurogroup, said everyone knows that the economy within the euro area is slowing down. In October, economic growth for the euro area stood at 0.5%, adding, "If we look at high-frequency indicators and the economic sentiment, we see that many things point to a contraction in economic activity this winter." The finance ministers representing the 19-country euro area met in Brussels, Belgium recently to discuss the Eurozone's economic development as well as budgetary measures to mitigate the impact of high energy prices. According to estimates by the European Commission, euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 200 billion euros, or 1.25% of the European Union's gross domestic product GDP, on energy support for the year. Pascal Donohue said around 70% of the supporting measures adopted by the member states so far are untargeted, meaning they benefit all or a very large share of the population. He added, "We are aware, of course, that targeting is not always easy, politically and technically, especially if you have to react very quickly. This is also why we have the expectation that this targeting of measures can improve in the coming months." Pascal Donohue added, "The ministers noticed the challenges of significant support and effectively managing the trade-off between reducing inflation while supporting both vulnerable households and the euro area's international competitiveness." British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. According to a survey, one in four Europeans described their financial position as precarious. More than half see a serious risk it will become so over the coming months, and 80% have already been forced into hard spending choices. As the cost of living crisis driven by high energy prices, rampant inflation, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict tightens its grip, the six-country survey for the French anti-poverty NGO Secours Populaire painted an alarming picture of a continent on the brink. More than half, or 54%, of more than 6,000 people across France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Poland, and the United Kingdom told the pollster Ipsos their purchasing power had fallen over the past 3 years, mostly because of higher food prices, higher fuel prices, heating and rent bills. The hardest hit country was Greece, where 68% of respondents said their spending power had fallen a lot or somewhat since 2019. This was followed by France in second position with 63%, Italy in third position with 57%, Germany in fourth position with 54%, and Britain in fifth position with 48%. Poland was in sixth position with 38%. About 80% of respondents said they had already been forced to make significant compromises, including cutting down on travel, 62%, cutting down on heating, 47%, borrowing from friends and family, 42%, finding a second job, 40%, and skipping their meals, 29%. Across the six countries, 64% said they were now often or sometimes unable to decide what to cut next, as they had already cut what they could have cut. 28% said they were overdrawn by mid-month, and 27% often or sometimes feared losing their home. On average, about 27% of respondents across the six countries said their financial and material situation was precarious, defined as one unexpected expenditure could change everything.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends, and let us reflect on what the Prophet's divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, has said about prosperity in life, and salvation in afterlife. Charity is an effective cure, and the actions of people in their present life will be before their eyes in the next life.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, following Prophet Abraham. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of following Prophet Abraham alayhi salam in the Islamic lifestyle. When we see the life of the Prophet Abraham alayhi salam, we see the wordings like La uhibbul afilin, I don't love those who fall, who go downwards. And this is a lesson from the Prophet, from the life of the Prophet Abraham for us, that we as a Muslim should not love something that has a fall. Why? Because we want to go towards the perfection. And perfection means to improve every day, to go towards the perfection, to go to the peaks of perfection. And therefore, it is climbing up every single time. It's not going down. Therefore, the Prophet Abraham has said that La uhibbul afilin, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who has created us, who is the most perfect existence, and he is wajibul wujud, he is the necessary existence in this world. And we must love him if we want to love something. We must love the most perfect thing, so that when we are loving Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we are going towards the perfection. But if we start loving the non-perfect things, then obviously we will have uful, we will go down, we will fall down, we go toward downwards. You know, this world, it has uful, this world has a downfall. The people who love this world, they will just remain in this world. But in hereafter, they do not have a rise, they don't climb, they don't go towards the peaks of perfection, they don't have high ranks in that world. Therefore, we must be careful when we are loving something. Therefore, we must love the perfect, the most perfect thing in this world, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of following the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that the Prophet Ibrahim used to love the most perfect thing, and that's why he said, La uhibbul afalin, I don't love those who have a fall or those go downwards. Therefore, we must go toward the perfection. On the other hand, the lesson that we need to learn from the life of the Prophet Ibrahim alayhi salam being a Muslim in order to have a good Islamic lifestyle is that when you love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you need to trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We must trust on Allah Almighty the way the Prophet Abraham alayhi salam used to trust Allah. We know that in the Quran Allah has mentioned the story that, you know, when the Namrud, he wanted to burn Prophet Abraham alayhi salam, what he did is he gathered the wood and he ordered on the government level. Now look at the king, that the king of a place is ordering to burn someone. And he is the god of some people. When he orders something, how many woods would be gathered? You know, people were thinking that gathering wood against Abraham at that time is a good deed. It is a thawab. It has a reward. Whereas, obviously, they were following the king. So they gathered the woods of that time on anything that can be burned. And they made a fire. And the fire was so high that no one could go next to the fire. So no one could go next to the fire. So what happened is there is the time when they wanted to take Abraham alayhi salam towards that fire, they couldn't take it. So therefore, they brought a catapult in order to throw him into the fire. And when they throw Ibrahim alayhi salam, the Quran says that the birds came to ask that, shall we come and help you? He said, no. The angels came. They wanted to help him. He said, no. He said, the one who has created me, the one who I believe he knows that I'm being thrown into the fire, so he will help me. And then Allah made that fire cold for Ibrahim alayhi salam. Kuni bardan wa salama. Be peaceful and cold upon the Ibrahim. Now, this is the belief of Ibrahim, that when he trusts Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, we must also trust. There is another thing here, that in this story, it tells about a bird who had some water in his mouth, and it was flowing towards the fire, and the angels and other birds, they asked him that, why are you doing so? The bird answered that, I can just do this. This is in my, you know, capacity, that I can take some water in my mouth and put in the fire, no matter whether it's, you know, it's making this fire cold or not. I'm performing my duty. So the story gives us the lesson that if we want to have an Islamic lifestyle, we must perform our duty, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A2Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Welcome to The Sideline, where we discuss the latest hot topics of the FIFA World Cup 2022. I'm your host, Hamza Khayoun. Today, we'll explore the stunning solidarity shown with the resistant people of Palestine throughout this competition. Scenes of jubilation at Moroccan and Tunisian victories have been accompanied by patriotic songs supporting Palestine. From pitch invasions to confrontation of Israeli journalists, this World Cup has shown the normalization push for the region is doomed to fail. While some misguided regimes seek to ingratiate themselves with only the Zionist entity, The people of the region vehemently reject these actions. We'll hear from experts on this subject, but before that, we have a special report on some of the breathtaking displays of solidarity the tournament has witnessed.
This World Cup has seen an outpouring of support for the Palestinian cause. While this is not new, it has never been on such an international stage. There have been stunning examples of support for Palestine in the world of football, such as the stand taken by Celtic fans and even a special twinning of the club with the Aida refugee camp. Footballers have gone to great lengths to show they support the liberation of Palestine. This time, though, the fans have taken center stage. Israeli journalists have struggled to convince people to talk to them, even finding themselves unable to engage fans from Japan and Brazil. The situation has gotten to the point that the Zionist entity has advised those from the settler colony not to travel to Qatar anymore because of the discomfort they may face there. Many have pointed to the gulf between Israeli journalists being ignored or shouted down in Qatar and Palestinian journalists being killed in occupied Palestine. There's a board dedicated to Shireen Abu Akhle in Qatar, which has been decorated with signs of respect from World Cup goers. Here at the sideline, we've collated some of the most epic examples of solidarity with Palestine shown in Qatar this month. Fans of both Tunisia and Morocco have been holding massive banners with the words Free Palestine during their matches. A Saudi Arabian supporter was recorded vehemently telling Israeli journalist Moa Vardi that he was not welcome in Qatar. It is Palestine, there is no Israel.
You are not welcome here. Even if this is Qatar, this is our country. You are not welcome here. There is only Palestine. There is no Israel.
An Israeli journalist was even forced to lie, claiming he came from Ecuador to cover his affiliation to the Zionist entity. Perhaps he did. As the competition approached, Zionist media speculated if this was the World Cup that could serve as a vehicle through which Qatar could be dragged into the normalization camp. However, as was revealed, even those from states that have normalized relations with Israel are unambiguously rejecting it. Whilst Palestine is not qualified for the World Cup 2022, its pulsating presence is felt as a reminder of a people striving to be free.
We are joined in the studio by our resident football analyst, Mo Haider. Mo was a key figure in the development of Arsenal Fan TV, where he was eventually dismissed for his public support for the Palestinian cause. Now he runs his own YouTube channel, where he provides cutting-edge analysis and incisive commentary on the latest Arsenal games. We are joined on Skype by Sami Ramadani. Sami is an Iraqi-born lecturer in sociology and writes on Iraq and Middle East current affairs. He was a political exile from Saddam's regime, but campaigned against US-led sanctions and the invasion and occupation of Iraq. He's a member of the Steering Committee of Stop the War Coalition. Thank you very much for joining me, gentlemen. So, Mo, did you expect such a strong presence in this competition for the Palestinians?
Well, given that Palestine didn't qualify for the World Cup, you tell me what other country didn't qualify and has had such a strong presence. I didn't expect it to the extent that we've seen it. And look, clearly the presence of Palestine is not in the field of play, but it's in the hearts of the people. And it's a really, really lovely thing to see.
Sami, what do you think the support for the Palestinians says about the normalization push in the region?
Well, it revealed so starkly the huge gulf that exists between the Arab regimes and the masses in general. The Arab masses have shown for the first opportunity, or rather used the first opportunity where the world media is focused on Qatar and the World Cup. They showed how much they love Palestine and how much they do support the Palestinian people and reject any notion of normalization with the occupation of Palestine. And that stark example is not unique, but it is unique in the sense that the world media were present and the world could see how much the Arab people and actually people from other nations raised the Palestinian flag and rejected talking to Israeli journalists. So it was a reminder, a very
And in fact, a slap in the face as well for both the Israeli occupation of Palestine and for the Arab regimes who are trying to normalize relations with the Zionists.
Absolutely. Mo, what did you make of that pitch invasion during Tunisia's victory over France?
Well, pitch invasions generally, not something I condone, but as soon as something is done with a Palestine presence, given the pressure that anything Palestine-related faces, especially in the West, I'm all for it. And frankly, if anyone was to have an issue with the pitch invasion, I'd focus on the issues that are going on in Palestine as something that's far more worthy of our focus and our complaints. So the pitch invasion, though it's not really shown on broadcasters because they try to keep attention away from these things, on social media, you can all see it. And you have to admit, the backflip was brilliant.
Sammy, we saw an Israeli journalist claiming he was from Ecuador, and Israelis now have been advised not to travel to Qatar. Has this competition been an embarrassment for the Zionist entity?
Actually, much more than an embarrassment, because you could see that the Israeli media were trying to show the people in the world that Israel has been accepted and the people are okay with their journalist presence. And suddenly they met with this incredible hostility and a reminder that Palestine and the occupation of Palestine is a key issue for the Arab people in general and for actually people from across the world, that Palestine and occupied Palestine will never be forgotten. And the Israeli ploy to show that normalization is a normal event has It countered on them, and they failed miserably to prove any point except that the people reject them.
Mo, what's been your favourite pro-Palestine moment in this competition?
Well, actually, do you know what? It's not one individual moment. It's actually one thing that's happened on numerous occasions, and that is the reaction of normal match-going fans to Israeli journalists. It's so, so important that we never allow this to be normalised. It's not normal to breach international law. It's not normal that human rights organisations are concluding that there is apartheid in this region. So the reaction of fans in such an organic manner to say, no, we're not going to normalise this, we do not want to have anything to do with you and we reject your presence, is brilliant. And crucially, from every clip that I have seen, it's been done without abusive behaviour or abusive language. It's just a polite but very firm and assertive rejection, and long may it continue.
Sammy, we have even seen Saudis denouncing Israeli journalists at the stadiums. What message will that send to the Saudi regime?
Actually, it was quite important, even though it was one individual, because there is a lot of repression in Saudi of people expressing opinions nowadays, supporting the Palestinian people and rejecting Israeli occupation. So that person was extremely brave confronting the Israeli journalist. The Saudi regime is known to have secret relations with the Israeli occupation. And recently, these things have become more public with the permission of flights and Israeli visits to Saudi. So the Saudi regime has cornered itself in a way, because the feelings are running quite high that this will be rejected, and the Saudi regime has put its wrong foot forward, because normally they hide behind the scenes.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us on the sideline today. We'll be back throughout the tournament with more debate and analysis. Until then, goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
$8 trillion in U.S. taxpayer money has been given to U.S. defense contractors over the last 20 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote, "The four corporations are representatives of the modern-day piracy, that is, the U.S. war industry, a corporate capture of U.S. foreign policy, the Congress, the Departments of Defense and State, and the U.S. economic system. What is it like to be so ashamed of the company for whom you work that you cannot bring yourself to admit you work there? Ashamed of the products they manufacture, the innocent people those products kill, the hundreds of billions of dollars of public taxpayer money squandered in a gluttonous pursuit of profits. This is life as seen on November 10th, 2022, as Raytheon Technologies in Arlington, VA, members and supporters of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, a public tribunal, served subpoenas on four United States weapons manufacturers, charging them with war crimes, crimes against humanity, theft, and bribery. The other three corporations served that same day were Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and General Atomics. These four corporations are representatives of modern-day piracy, that is, the U.S. war industry, a corporate capture of U.S. foreign policy, the Congress, the Departments of Defense and State, and the U.S. economic system." Raytheon Technologies occupies a towering office building in Arlington, a stone's throw from the Pentagon and Arlington National Cemetery, two sites commemorating death and the utter of failure of war. Though the Raytheon building has its corporate logo plastered in blood-red letters at the top, once inside no sign exists evidencing this corporate war profiteer. No name, no logo, no recipient. A sad attempt to hide their dealings in the black art of war. When asked, security guards refused to acknowledge Raytheon was in the building. Of the dozens of employees who passed, none would admit they worked at Raytheon, averting their eyes as they hurried away. When police arrived to escort the tribunal members and supporters off premises, the police would not acknowledge Raytheon was headquartered there. Just like the employees, they had their orders. Keep quiet, admit nothing. It was silent as a tomb except for the voices of the tribunal members speaking the truth about the trail of suffering and death Raytheon and his corporate brethren have left across Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Somalia, and the Palestinian-occupied territory. Meanwhile, these merchants of death have left the United States financially, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. Raytheon Technologies has a market capitalization of $96 billion. According to Macro Trends, Raytheon Technologies' revenue for the quarter ending September 30, 2022 was $16.951 billion, a 4.55% increase year over year. For 2021, it was $64.388 billion, a 13.79% increase from 2020. For 2022 was $56.587 billion, a 24.78 8% increase from 2019, and for 2019 was $45.349 billion, a 30.68% increase from 2018. In 4 years, they have garnered almost a 70% increase in revenue. Marketing death is good for profits if you can live it yourself. Apparently, given their silence, many Raytheon employees struggle with this very issue. Raytheon builds some of the most destabilizing, destructive, and expensive weapons on Earth. The hypersonic missile, which travels in excess of 5 times the speed of sound, Mach 5, covering vast distances in minutes. It is hard to stop and flies nimbly to avoid detection and dodge defensive countermeasures. All these are attributes which make the missile so destabilizing to a foreign leader who has only minutes to determine whether they are being attacked with a nuclear weapon. Raytheon makes the Peregrine air-to-air missile, which they claim increases firepower, penetrates bad weather, and goes the distance. Add to that their plans to use high-power microwaves in war, and we see the epitome of a merchant of death. Boeing, General Atomics, and Lockheed Martin are the same. They, too, revel in blood money as they build for war and drain the U.S. economy. In fact, some $8 trillion in U.S. taxpayer money has been given to U.S. defense contractors over the last 20 years. The U.S. war industry plays a key role in fomenting war with their congressional lobbying, not just pushing for weapons contracts, but influencing military strategy, thereby exacerbating and prolonging the anguish of civilians bearing the brunt of these wars of choice. On the issue of war in particular, Congress must be answerable to its citizens, not a handful of corporations. With their silence on November 10th, these weapons manufacturers revealed their shame. Their corporate mission statement is war begets profit. For the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, the mission statement is come war profiteers, give account, stand before a tribunal and be judged. And so, what is it like to give your talents to a corporation which hides its very existence? To give all your efforts and education and experience in the creation of weapons which kill indiscriminately? Their loss of words, their averting eyes, the damning silence offered in their corporate crypt is the devastating answer. Meanwhile, the website of Hill wrote, "The first order of business for the post-midterm elections lame duck session of Congress should be an agreement on a budget framework and passage of fiscal year 2023 appropriations bills. This critical task should be done before Congress adjourns at the end of the year. Most importantly, it must be completed prior to December 16th deadline of the current continuing resolution. Under this CR, the Defense Department is losing up to $207 million in buying power per day. The new Congress should not have to start its session with urgent old business hanging over its head and increasing damage to national security. Defense needs at least $824 billion in fiscal year 2023 to mitigate inflation, modernize, and support the force. And the process of reaching a budget agreement will unfortunately likely include discussions again about defense, non-defense budget parity, a better understanding of what is in the defense budget. The largest single piece of discretionary spending can help. This country has always and will always debate how to appropriately spend taxpayer dollars. It should, but what does and should guide thinking